The following podcast contains strong language and frank conversations about topics that some listeners may find upsetting.
Bingo, that's all we want. That's exactly what we want, is just to give people the tools and the skills and help them develop a sense of, I'm okay, I'm absolutely fine, I've got what I need to get on with my life. There will be tough times, there will be good times, but that's the same for everybody. And I'm not different in that respect, and I deserve as good a life as anybody else.
Welcome to Positive Advice, the podcast from Chiva. Chiva is a charity that supports children, young people, and young adults growing up with HIV to become happier, healthier, and more in control of their own futures. We're all about putting young voices at the forefront of the conversation on HIV. I'm Eli, your host for this series, and joining me, as always, is Chiva's CEO, Amanda Ely. Welcome back, Amanda.
Hi, Eli.
Helping us today is Dr. Thomas Campbell, a clinical psychologist who has spent many years working with people living with HIV. Hi, Thomas.
Hi, Eli. Hi, Amanda.
Welcome to the show. Could you possibly tell us a little bit about your work in HIV?
Well, my work in HIV and with people with HIV started in about 1990, and that was sort of mid the pandemic amongst gay men in London. And I was working as a clinical psychologist in a small London hospital, and we noticed that there had been a big increase in referrals of people who were clearly very distressed about their HIV status. So I put forward a case to my manager and we secured some funding, and I then developed a half-time psychology post within the local sexually transmitted infection clinic, and then it kind of grew from there. And out of that grew my interest in working with people in a much more substantial way, and I then spent a couple of years working in Zambia in a HIV program. And at that point, it was 1993 to 1995. This was pre-HART. This was pre-antiretrovirals. So everybody with HIV had a very, very uncertain future at that point. But working in Zambia taught me a huge amount. I think I probably learned more than I actually gave. And what I learned was about resilience, about creativity, around the extraordinary capacity for life that people have. And gratitude for the things that people actually were able to engage with. So I think that kind of changed my life. I came back to London, started working in a full-time post in the NHS with people with HIV and also with drug and alcohol issues. That taught me another huge amount. And eventually I ended up working in East London, where we developed services for African people, mostly living with HIV, and mostly young people who were mostly of African origin living with HIV. And again, I ended up learning tons about not just HIV, but about life, about psychology, about psychotherapy, about how people facing very, very difficult situations preserve mental health, are able to cope with almost impossible situations, how they juggle all sorts of balls in the air at the same time, and are able to continue to live their lives in positive, hopeful, optimistic ways. So that's my 30 odd year career in a nutshell.
That's amazing. Thank you for sharing that. We're just about to delve a bit further into our topic, which today is mental health. And I was wondering, what are the typical mental health challenges you've encountered when working with young people specifically living with HIV?
I think the challenges often are about how do you make sense of something like HIV in a context where people are so afraid to talk about it in ordinary, fairly straightforward ways, and how those conversations are embedded within much bigger areas of fear and ignorance and stigma. And I think that is the big challenge. And when people are afraid to talk about things, what we all do is, if we're living with something, we think, well, you're afraid to talk about me. You're afraid to talk about me as a person, and I become the problem. And in fact, of course, nobody ever says, you're not the problem. It's other people's attitudes is the problem. It's stigma is the problem. It's the context in which we're living is the problem. Your life is not a problem. You personally are not a problem. What you are facing is the result of ignorance, fear, and stigma. Now, that's obviously a very difficult and complicated thing to say and requires a lot of peeling back. But often people end up feeling like they are a problem and when they are not the problem.
Mm-hmm. Amanda, I'm going to ask you a similar question. What do you think is the mental health challenges affecting young people living with HIV?
Following on from what Tomas was just describing, really, which is a sort of complicated social context in which HIV sits, where stigma really shapes how people feel about HIV, how people talk about HIV, or very often how they don't talk about HIV. Like Tomas said, you know, this isn't an individual problem. The problem doesn't sit with the person. It's about a context around somebody. And you know, with HIV as well, it's very often not that alone that we're thinking about. You know, it's all the other experiences that people may well have had. Sadly, lots of bereavement. You know, lots of children have lost people in their families because of HIV. You know, lots of other difficulties in their lives, maybe having moved here from another country at an age in their childhood where it can be unsettling. Lots of, you know, maybe a lack of support that you might have had if you were surrounded by all your extended family, all these other things which shape the experience of HIV in a child's life, in a family's life.
And then adding the stress of growing up in current society.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right. I think it's time that we dig back into the archive once again. And let's begin with Kareem. He shared his story with us in Montreal back in 2022. He told Chiva about his challenging university experience.
So when I got to college, I was alone. There was no one. I was staying on my own. I was not staying with my auntie anymore. I was not staying with any relative anymore. Like, I have all the time in this world to myself. But I feel I'm a loser. I feel HIV, I'm going to die after all. What's the point? So I don't go for classes. I choose which classes to go for. I choose which one not to go. I ended up in my first year in university because my course in Nigeria, I have to take 5 years. Imagine 5 good years. It's so tough in Nigeria.
Yeah.
So tough. So I spent 5 years. And my first year, I had a very terrible result, but I'm not surprised. And I knew it was coming. So I knew I didn't go for the classes. I didn't go for exams. So second year went the same way. I just got to my exams. I will cry while I was writing my exams. So the only thing you see on my paper, sometimes I don't even write my names, is drops of tears. I cry almost every time. My father, while he was alive, before he fell sick, he had like prospects to be someone great. He was like one of the big men in Nigeria politics. I was sure that if he was alive, my life, my family, everything would have been a good one.
We've just heard there from Kareem about finding university a real challenge and a struggle following his father's death. And I was sort of wondering, Tomas, what advice can you give to someone who recently suffered a bereavement?
Oh, that's a tough one, because I think in the, you know, what you hear in Kareem's story is the kind of the vulnerability that a parental death leaves anybody with. Now, parental death is always difficult, no matter what age you are. But when you experience parental death when you are a teenager, and as I presume Kareem was, what that does is that it just leaves a big hole in your life when you had expected that you would have a parent who would help you, guide you, support you through the ordinary but difficult experiences of growing up. We need somebody who's got our backs. And when we fail, as we all have failed, or we find something difficult, or we don't get an assignment in on time, and you then have somebody that you can ring up and say, I don't know what to do. And they say, okay, right, come home for the weekend, or, you know, call me tomorrow, or I'm going to call you tomorrow and we're going to do this together and I'll help you. And, you know, will I call your tutor? No, don't call my tutor because I'm la la la. But, you know, somebody who helps you solve things and think about things and thinks things through and has essentially is providing you with that safety blanket. And then it's taken away. And, you know, you really hear in Kareem's story how deeply that affected him and led to a sense of just being lost. Mm. And he got lost and nobody noticed, or if they did notice, they weren't his parents who were able to say, okay, Karim, it's time to get back into the saddle. And he felt that nobody cared for him. And also in there was the HIV. Maybe worrying, I don't know what his dad died from, worrying about himself. Will I die? Is that what's going to happen to me? His dad died young. Will I die young? Are my prospects going to be taken away from me? Can I dream about having a good life? Can I dare to imagine that I'll be able to fulfill my ambitions? And I guess what really came across was his not really having anybody to talk through those worries, those concerns. And maybe if he had been able to just very simply say, I feel lost, I feel I'm in bits, my life has been ripped apart by my dad's death, I don't know what to do, I'm lost. And somebody was able to say, sit down there, have a cup of tea, have a biscuit, tell me how you're feeling. Maybe things would have been different for him. But you can see for Karim, or you can hear in Karim's story, that there was already a vulnerability about, you know, life because of his HIV status. And perhaps that's one of the things that HIV does, is that it brings into somebody's life at far too young an age an awareness of a big thing in your life that is unwanted, that you didn't create, but that is there and it has to be managed. And most kids don't have to manage anything as big as HIV, but people with HIV do have to manage it. And it is a big thing.
You touched on a little bit about a support network and how maybe Karim's father was a big part of that support network, and how, you know, going to university often for many young people living with HIV is the first time they're away from that support network. What would you say to people who are probably about to embark on this experience of moving away and living with HIV?
When, you know, people are going to university, they want to go, they want to have a good time, they want to focus on their subject, they're looking forward to making a new life, making new friends, establishing new networks, creating new opportunities. And then there's this other bloody thing that has to be thought about. And it's boring and it's perhaps a bit distressing, but in order for the rest of one's life to be successful, this is the bit that needs a bit of attention. Who will I talk to? What will my support network be? Where will my GP be? Is there an HIV support group locally? Do I have the numbers of my clinical nurse specialist in my phone so that if something goes wrong, I know who I can call and I can get the support I need as quickly as I need it?
Following on from that, for those who do, say, struggle with that planning aspect and finding a support group or finding a GP or finding someone they can trust. And I think a theme throughout what Karim sort of said is this sort of feeling of isolation from these social situations, and how would it be possible to combat this isolation?
Do some research, or you ask your current doctor or nurse about support networks in the new place I'm going to. Do you know anybody who I can go to, you know, near to where my university will be? Is there somebody, you know, you can recommend to me? And if you recommend that I can trust them, then I will perhaps take your word for it. Are there other people locally that you might know of that I could link in with? If you, you know, I mean, Chiva is a national organization, so being in touch with Chiva, as many young people are, and the Chiva youth group, perhaps asking somebody from the youth group, do you know of anybody? And taking a bit of a risk. And then what we often find is when we meet our fears head on, that the fear is suddenly goes away and we come away thinking, well, that was quite easy and nothing bad happened. So maybe I don't have to be so worried about this.
Something we think a lot about at Chiva is normalizing HIV. It has been very important to develop specialist services around HIV over the years in order to respond to some of the unique challenges and experiences that people may have around HIV. But it's also really important to normalise HIV, and actually accessing support should be possible for students from all of the other services that will be available to students in universities. there is an increased concern about students' mental health and well-being more widely. And so we will see many more initiatives and responses to those needs being developed within universities, as they're having to recognise that actually we need to support students' mental health. We need to support them to cope with a lot of the stresses and demands of student life. And I think there's a really important role in for an organisation like Cheever, for example. What can we do to ensure that some of those general welfare services in universities are well equipped and well informed to support students who may come to them who are living with HIV, so that those students may feel comfortable to talk about HIV and anything else that's causing them worry and difficulty in university without feeling concerned about what happens to the information or how people are going to respond. And so that's kind of a job for people like us, if you like. And also, I think, much as Thomas was saying about planning, it's about the work that we can do with young people before they go. It's a bit like you're moving into adult life plan. You know, transition isn't just about getting your healthcare from your adult clinic as opposed to your paediatric clinic. It's about transitioning into your adult life. You know, what kind of skills do you need to do that well and for this to be comfortable? And how can we help you prepare for that? And one of the things we've been doing quite a lot in recent years is helping students think about whether they want to tell their university about their HIV. And, you know, there are a lot of benefits from doing that, and it can be done in a planned, careful way so that people feel still really in control of the information. But it does mean that you're already kind of setting up a space in which you can hopefully feel comfortable to talk about what you need if that time arises whilst you're a student, because you've kind of already laid the foundations a little bit. And people should feel entitled to get the support they need from wherever it's available, not just kind of having to seek and search for an HIV specialist service, you know.
Let's hear now from Portia about her experiences.
Because I don't know, also that's something that's different from being a vertical as opposed to someone who contracted HIV through their behavior or later on in life. I don't know a life without HIV. Like, HIV is my normality. And I guess I don't feel a sense of shame or guilt in the way in which I contracted it. And it's always been a part of my life. And I didn't start feeling any shame or stigma until it was taught to me. So, like, when I started speaking out and sharing my story, it was mainly to people who didn't contract it at birth. And so that was what they would express to me, how that was so inspiring to them and helping them combat their shame and their guilt. And, you know, like, it is a little different because it's been a part of my life for my whole life, you know? And I just feel like that's, now in hindsight, like, this is what I was called to do, to change the perspective of what it means to live with HIV. It's not just a gay man's disease, or it's not just something that you get from not behaving. Like, you don't have to be promiscuous to get HIV.
Do you think that Portia is right? Do people born with HIV have a stronger resilience to the negativity and stigmas that can be attached?
Oh, that's such a great question. I think the world has changed. Mm-hmm. And I think for lots of young people who have grown up in an era where HIV is a bit more normalized, and certainly in an era where antiretroviral drugs have been available, that HIV has somehow ceased to be less important. Portia's account was really interesting, wasn't it? Because what she very, very cleverly did was she actually put her finger on the nature of how stigma works and how HIV has become associated with people and behaviours that were made a problem by other people. So gay men, always been a problem in society. And gay men, unwanted, considered to be promiscuous and deviant and didn't fit in and were unwanted, and their behavior became associated with HIV, and that's how stigma became created about HIV. She also pointed to people who were considered to be promiscuous, and of course everybody's definition of promiscuous is just one more person that you had sex with than I did, and that's promiscuous, but of course my behaviour is not promiscuous. So coming back to your question, I think it's complicated. I think young people are more sophisticated than older generations. They've grown up with lots of information about HIV. But at the same time, I think if you've acquired HIV, you might also be living in a family that is uncomfortable with HIV. And often the conversations about HIV are difficult to have.
Amanda, did you have anything to add on to that?
I think that young people who connect in spaces with their peers and feel accepted and can have conversations which are relatable for other peers, you know, the whole, wow, you feel like that, I feel like that all the time kind of experience that we know exists a lot in these spaces. I think that those experiences of acceptance in your peer group and knowing that your experiences are shared can do a lot to help build resilience and hope, especially if you are then in, you know, in those spaces able to see the lives of your older peers doing well, going well, you know, going off to university as we just spoke about.
True.
Becoming a parent, doing great stuff, or just doing normal regular stuff. You know, you don't have to be championing living your best life in every way to be a really good role model for someone. You're just able to sort of provide through your experience an indication to someone younger than you that, oh, okay, well, you know, maybe things will be okay.
Yeah.
It upsets me still that young people will arrive, say, at Cheever Camp and genuinely think that they could never have their own family, you know, still today.
It's heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking. And, you know, and when we finish a week later and we're all on our knees and then someone writes on their evaluation form at the end, this week I learn I can be a parent. This week I learn I can have my own family.
You sort of watch their eyes widen at the concept of everything in their lives just not actually being so boundaried as they think it is.
Absolutely. Or limited or restricted by HIV. And it's you know, you just think, wow, all it really took was a week of getting right information into you, you know, from sitting in these workshops.
It's not even a week, though. It's like 5 days.
Yeah.
And that's even wilder in that sense.
I was at the Cheever conference 2 years ago, and one young man whom I hadn't seen for about 5 or 6 years, he used to come to an event that I used to organise in East London, and he said, "Thomas, you won't remember me." I said, "Of course I remember you. And how's it going? You know, lovely to see you. God, my God, you've grown, da da da." And he said, "Well, here I am. I'm here with my girlfriend, and this is our baby." And I thought, oh that's oh my God, that's such a beautiful story. And what that young man was telling me was, I hope I'm not putting words in his mouth, you know, that what his experience was of just being able to be with other young people, with adults who were not scared or to answer any question, who were straightforward about things, enabled him to go forward in his life and just be who he was and be the best dad to his daughter that he could be.
And now joining us is Roof. At a recent Cheever workshop, Roof listened to these same clips with other young people at the charity. Roof, after listening to this archive footage, what reactions did you get from the Cheever group?
So the reactions we got were quite similar to what you guys have already spoken about. But to be more specific, when we listened to Kareem's clip, there was quite a big conversation on HIV bringing expectation to the self-sustainability of your life as a young person. And I'm sure we'll talk about this more in the health and treatment episode, but I think the concept of you being in charge of your own medication and you being in charge of looking after yourself was a very big topic, and being enrolled with that at quite a young age is quite a big thing, especially for someone who's 14, 15, 16, and being told for the first time that they have HIV and that they have to take medication daily. And I think we found that that was important and worth bringing up, that the idea of taking your own medication, looking after your health, is a very big thing to put on a young person. And so that gave anxiety, that gave the feeling of inadequacy if they didn't take their medication, or failure. And so that was one thing that came up. And then looking at Portia's clip, we spoke a lot about the fact that not everyone born with HIV has that resilience to be a face or to be an activist. And I think people who needed more help are actually very much saying, yes, it's awesome that some people are resilient. And like what Portia said about how it's brought her resilience, not everyone has that. And for some people, it might do the opposite. And it might actually put them more in a shell. And it might actually put them more in a introverted bubble where they don't want to share. And so I think that leads into the question that I'm going to ask you, Tomas, that the young people at Chiva highlighted that some of the stigma young people face can be self-stigma. So how do you build resilience and self-love?
Oh, well, thank you for an amazingly difficult question to answer. And if I knew the answer to this, I would have the Nobel Prize for something. Okay, so how do we develop resilience? Well, I think, you know, the ways in which we develop resilience are by going through tough times and coming out the other side and then being able to reflect on how did I get through that thing? And it doesn't matter what the thing is, whether it's learning how to ride a bike, learning how to swim, learning how to skateboard or draw or cook. And when you're doing it, you make mistakes and you think, okay, well, I made the mistake and la la, and now I've learned, now when I go back and I do it better the next time, and then I achieve. And then we have a sense of pride, we have a sense of being able to do things. We know we can learn, we can problem solve. And those are the ways in which we become resilient. What does resilience mean? It means being able to not give up when you fail the first time. It means that you're able to forgive yourself for making mistakes. It also means you forgive other people when they make mistakes, because other people do make mistakes that affect you. It realizes that you're not perfect. It also means that you can learn and you can adapt and you can be resourceful and you can be creative and you can overcome things. Now, what affects all of those things is the burden of carrying a secret that you feel makes you unacceptable. And that's where the work that I've done with young people has been about that sense of nothing good is going to happen to me, and try to change that framework in which people are thinking about themselves.
The next question I have is a bit pointed towards you, Amanda. Kareem's clip that we heard earlier was talking a lot about loneliness. And one respondent in the workshop said on the same topic that their kind of idea of dealing with loneliness is A, speak to friends with HIV about HIV, and if not, speak to other friends who don't have HIV in hope that they would understand. If those don't work, what is the next step? And are those previous steps good steps?
Thanks, Ruth. I mean, we're talking here a lot about feeling accepted, how to support somebody in believing in themselves and believing in their own personal value as a unique, worthy human being of, you know, worthy of somebody's time and attention and affection in any context which they're thinking about, be it friendships, be it, you know, more intimate relationships, etc. And so we're thinking kind of, I suppose, here really holistically about what somebody needs to kind of live well, live happily. And we know that acceptance and closeness in your peer group is something that can make you feel a lot better often. So those responses about, you know, somebody saying, well, actually, my first response if I feel lonely or I feel like maybe self-stigma is really affecting how I can live my life, my first response would be to talk to friends with HIV, because clearly somebody there is saying, well, they're the most likely people who are going to get it, who are going to maybe relate to what I'm saying. And then they're going to possibly say things like, I get you, I've been there myself. And when I was there, these were the things that helped me, or I was there then, but I'm not now. And like Tomas, you know, Tomas's reference to the young man he met years later at a Chiva event, who's now a father. You know, it's that understanding that in life, nothing stays the same, and you are always, you know, going through something that's transitory. And then their second suggestion was, if you don't have access to that, because not everybody's got access to peers who also live with HIV. The second suggestion was, well, if not that, then maybe you've got other friendships where you feel safe enough to talk about some of these things. Now, when people feel, and this is not uncommon, this is something we hear a lot, when people feel that they simply cannot tell anybody in their friendship group or in their wider family group, that it's just too frightening to begin to think about how to do that, and people can feel very fearful about rejection and whether that's a genuinely likely thing to happen or not. That's not really for us to say. If that's how someone's feeling, then that's a reality. I think this is where, you know, we go back to this need for what a kind of clinic can offer someone. It's so important to think that, well, if this is the space where I can talk about my HIV, it's my clinic, maybe there's nowhere else in your life that you do. Is there anyone in that clinic who you can talk to about some of these experiences? Because it's so important that there is a space in your life where you feel you can have that conversation and somebody's going to even just listen and acknowledge and understand, show you some understanding for what you're feeling. It's so, so important. And this is where, you know, when we were talking about the need for holistic care in our clinical services is so important, because it isn't simply taking a pill a day. We know that. We know that, you know, managing HIV in a whole array of social and personal situations can be complicated, and people can need some help to navigate that in order for them to truly be able to live well. So I would say next stop clinic, if you know.
Yeah, because the good thing with clinics, especially youth clinics, is some of them have sort of peer supporters. And I know this because in one of them I am a peer supporter. And it's just, even I, as someone people go for to be supported by, the other person talking to me is living with HIV. We're learning off of each other. And it's always so nice, this conversation, because it is a two-way thing. And in the end, it does just feel like just having a chat. And I think that's a good point about going to your clinic, which I guess we'll talk more about. But that sort of importance of having a space where you can just exist and not hide anything and not be fearful of stigma, but to know that the environment you're in is safe.
Yeah. And it's important that when you go to your clinic that there is somebody there, you know, that is the person that's going to check in with you and is going to say, so how are you doing? Yeah, okay, not just have you taken your meds since you last came, but how are you actually doing? How's life? I remember last time you told me about, I don't know, a course you'd applied to get on. How did that go? You know, remembering something about someone's life so that they're going to feel in that moment in time, oh, I'm a valued person. You actually remember what I told you when I was here 3 months ago. I'm not just another patient coming through.
Thanks for listening to Positive Advice. I'm Eli Fitzgerald, and thank you to Amanda Ely, Ruth Muko, and Dr. Thomas Campbell for joining me today. In our next episode, we'll be exploring the role healthcare, our environment, and treatment has on people living with HIV and adding to our oral history. If you want to learn more about Chiva, or if you want to access clips and updates from the Positively Spoken project, then head to chiva.org.uk and follow the links there. Positive Advice is a TBI media production for Chiva.